We are talking once again with Jav Parrish, local writer and activist, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon, Jav.
Good afternoon. How are you doing?
Just dandy, now that the smoke has cleared a bit.
Yes, we can breathe again.
Lots of developments this week, starting with local. Actually, one that happened last week that we didn't mention was the departure of Merrick Bob.
Yeah, Merrick Bob was the court-appointed monitor who's been, the federal guy who's tracking the progress of the Seattle Police Department in its reform process, its formal reform process, which was mandated by the consent decree between the Department of Justice and Seattle Police Department, City of Seattle, some years ago. And, you know, the city has been moving to try and get that consent decree dismissed, that the Seattle Police Department is all better now. And has backed off of that this summer with the various scandals of how SPD has responded to anti-police protest, anti-police abuse protests in the wake of the George Floyd killing and throughout the summer. SPD has been, let's put this mildly, unnecessarily aggressive in some of its policing tactics. And that, of course, has simply stoked more protests. There have been more or less daily protests up until the bad smoke delayed them. But, throughout the summer and into the fall, and they look like they'll continue for the indefinite future. So Merrick Bob resigned last week, and he resigned specifically because of his dismay at how SPD was responding to the protests. And this has been a point of contention now between Carmen Best, who has resigned as police chief, and the new police chief, and the mayor, and the city council. It's really dominated Seattle politics this summer. And Merrick Bob had the feeling that the progress that was made during the reform process was being undone. Now, this is significant on its own merits because Bob did a very good job of being impartial in monitoring the progress of the police department, giving credit where it was due, but also being very critical where it was due. So the open question is, will he be replaced by the Trump administration and the judge overseeing the reform process? And if so, by who? And if so, on what timeline? Because it's a critical time in the police department where you have an interim police chief, you have, these ongoing protests that are highly critical of the police department and are shining a spotlight on police department abuses of all kinds, particularly in communities of color. He will be missed. He did a great job. But it tells you that how far afield Mayor Durkan was in trying to get the consent decree resolved, because the police department is all better now. And here you have the court appointed monitor saying, this is so off the rails that, I don't feel I can make any more progress here. So that's a very concerning insight from somebody who knows the reform process, as well as anybody on the ground. He will be missed. He did a great job, and it's a clear challenge and a clear message about Mayor Durkan's leadership as we go into her reelection effort in 2021.
Moving over across the mountains to Yakima, and the federal judge there issuing an injunction.
Yeah, this happened, I believe, Thursday night. And this was in a response to a lawsuit by 14 states against the Trump administration. The lawsuit was led by Attorney General Bob Ferguson, and it was filed in the state of Washington. And as a response to that lawsuit, which it was basically suing the Trump administration to undo the changes to the post office that were clearly intended to delay delivery of ballots. And of course, Washington State is a stakeholder in that, as one of four states where elections are held entirely by mail. So the federal judge in Yakima ruled Thursday night, issued a strong ruling in favor of Ferguson and against the Trump administration, which we've said that before. And the judge in the case basically said, yes, these changes in the National Post Office were clearly intended as a political move to delay delivery of ballots. Of course, they have a secondary move of doing things like critical medications that are also done through the mail, you know, bills, other things that people rely on. But the Trump administration, that wasn't their motivation. That was just a maybe unfortunate side effect of that. The motivation was to try and delay delivery of ballots, both from states and counties to individual voters, and then from voters back to the states and counties. Trump, of course, has been you know, bad mouthing voting by mail, saying it's rife with fraud, other things that are completely untrue. But he's been trying to undermine confidence in voting by mail. So this is part of a multi-pronged voter suppression effort by Republicans and Trump in particular, but other Republicans also, because they've all appointed themselves Trump mini-me's. So the judge in this case basically said this is clearly politically motivated, it's clearly unconstitutional, and he ordered a sweeping nationwide emergency remedy in response to Ferguson's suit, that the post office is supposed to undo all the changes that they made to delay the mail. Now, some of these can be undone, but some of them, like the voting machines that have been destroyed and can't be simply reconstituted, they're large, complicated machines, some of them cannot be redone. So it's unclear what, in effect, the injunction, the emergency injunction, which was granted to Ferguson's lawsuit, what impact that will have. First of all, whether the Trump administration will even comply with that, because they've shown utter contempt for court orders in things as wide ranging as congressional subpoenas, immigration lawsuits, etc. And they probably don't see any cost in defying it, simply because the court really can't do anything meaningful before the election, at which point a lot of it will be moot. But some of these things that can be done, the post office can resume paying overtime to letter carriers. They can resume distributing mail at the end of the day, rather than just leaving them at Saks for days and days, as has been the case in much of the country. And they can put some of the blue post office boxes back that have been removed from street corners. So there are things that the post office can do to undo some of the changes that they've undertaken. And we'll see what the timeline is on that. There are four states that are already doing starting early voting this week. North Carolina, Wyoming, I believe Virginia, and there's one other. So the election is upon us. It's a time that is very fraught, and as the weeks go on in the coming weeks, things are going to move very quickly. So we will do our best to stay on top of it for y'all. But that was Washington State's contribution to the national dystopia this week.
Also, this last week, Seattle has a seawall that's been problematic for years, and there was an accident there while they were trying to quickly take part of it apart.
Yeah, this is this happened last Sunday. Pier 58, which had already started separating from the seawall, there were construction workers trying to take it down because it had been closed as being unsafe. So some of it actually collapsed. A couple construction workers were injured. Fortunately, nobody was killed, but it made for some dramatic footage. But this is sort of a reminder that Seattle has been ignoring its critical infrastructure for years. We have had, the Magnolia Bridge was damaged in the 2001 earthquake, and it still has not been repaired. The South Park Bridge is finally being worked on. That also was damaged in the same quake. Roads are literally up to 20 years behind on their maintenance schedules. And, you know, it's not like Seattle hasn't had any wealth in its community. The problem is that, its budgets have been constrained both by cutbacks from the federal and state level and because, Seattle is constrained from taxing most of the wealth in our community. We have one of the wealthiest cities in the country and yet, we have things like this going on. So yeah, that's a function of the seawall, as you mentioned, which is, by many accounts crumbling. Climate change is making that worse because the water is more acidic. And so it eats away at the base of the seawall and the sides of it. And we got a further, kick in the teeth, as it were. I believe it was yesterday, the city closed the adjoining Pier 58, which is where the Great Wall is. So people will know where that is on the south side of downtown. Because that too is apparently unsafe at this point. So, you know, we've heard all this grandiose talk about redeveloping the waterfront. That's why the viaduct was torn down. A very overpriced, tunnel was built. That basically was a real estate deal, as we talked about ad nauseum over the last decade. And that's why the city was and the state was willing to spend so much money on a tunnel, that is now open to traffic. It's never going to pay for itself. And that, you know, was the most expensive option, but it was also the option that allowed an unfettered, access to the waterfront from downtown, with the idea of connecting the two and developing the waterfront as a tourist destination. It's very much been underutilized over the decades in Seattle. Well, that waterfront isn't going to be very attractive to anybody as if the seawall crumbles, and that is another huge infrastructure investment that needs to be made, and it's not entirely clear who will make it or how it can be paid for. But, it needs to be talked about because, you know, political decision makers have been punting that down the road for literally decades and it can't be punted anymore. Or all of the piers are going to collapse and the seawall is going to start going out to sea and it's not going to offer much protection for the city.
Speaking of Durkin, she is facing a potential recall, but also Seattle City Council person Shama Swant is now also apparently.
Yeah, there is a recall petition that has been filed with the Secretary of State, and that recall petition, there was a Superior Court judge named Jim Rogers that ruled he allowed it to go forward this week. There were six allegations against Swant that supposedly rose to the level of meriting her recall. And there are a lot of the same complaints we've been hearing all summer. And for that matter, in some cases for many years about Swant. And the motivation of the people who filed it, they're very much aligned with the local business community. So it's some of the same people who have been critical of Swant for years as well. The six charges include the evening rally shortly after the death of George Floyd that Swant had marched to City Hall, where they held a brief rally in City Hall. The allegation is that rally endangered janitorial workers at the City Hall. Of course, we haven't heard of any janitorial work because of COVID. Now, almost all the people at that rally, and there's plenty of video of it available on social media if you want to go hunting for it. Most of the people at that rally, if not all of them, were wearing masks. We haven't heard of anybody employed by the city who actually got COVID because of that rally. And it seems pretty unlikely at this point that we will. But that was one of the allegations that the judge allowed to go forward. Another one that he allowed to go forward alleging that that Swant has delegated employment decisions in her office to her political party, Socialist Alternative. Another one was that she used city resources to promote a ballot initiative. Now that ballot initiative is looks like it will go forward for next year as well. But there's four that he found were were valid enough to be a basis for a recall. Rogers dismissed the charges related to an allegation that she encouraged protesters to occupy Seattle Police Department's East Precinct. That's referring to CHOP, but they never actually occupied the East Precinct. The city abandoned it, and it stood empty. There were not protesters occupying it. They were occupying the streets around it, but that one was dismissed. And then he dismissed an allegation that, she had basically organized CHOP, helped create CHOP was the wording of it, which is simply untrue. She certainly visited the protest zone once it had happened, but she did not organize it. There were a couple. There was one other that was upheld, and that was that she organized a protest to Jenny Durkin's house, which is a place that's supposed to be in a disclosed location because of outstanding threats from her days as a U.S. attorney. Now, that one is particularly problematic because she just simply didn't organize it. She appeared at the march. She spoke at it. She didn't actually go along the march route with marchers, but she did speak at the march, and she did publicize it. But she absolutely did not organize it. And I don't understand why the judge let that one go forward, because it's simply not true. The others are arguable, but you know, you can make a case for them. But that one is simply false. So it is now in organizers' hands to get enough signatures on the ballot for it to qualify for the ballot. I mean, on the petition for it to qualify for the ballot. It's fairly likely that organizers can be successful at that. The threshold is much less than what the number of people who voted against Sawant in her reelection last year, for example. That one's going forward. As you mentioned, there's also a recall petition against Jenny Durkin that is gathering signatures at this point. And both of those would probably, if they qualify, be a roughly similar timeline for an election early next year.
Well, makes one wonder if Egan O'Ryan is going to take another crack at that seat.
If there is a special election, Sawant would be ineligible to run again. I assume Socialist Alternative would put somebody else forward. Egan O'Ryan was the person who ran against Sawant last year, and had a kind of a dirty campaign and looked like he had a lot of momentum and then faded at the end and Sawant won. He's been trying to position himself for another run ever since. So, yeah, it wouldn't surprise me.
All right. And sticking with local, although tangential to national, I see our Attorney General Barr is looking towards Seattle again.
Yeah.
As if he doesn't have enough to do, you know?
Well, this was actually earlier this summer, and it was something that was reported this past week, however, that Attorney General William Barr, his response to the BLM protests this summer, he was trying to encourage federal prosecutors to explore federal sedition charges against protesters, largely peaceful protesters, I might add. I'm not sure what the basis of those sedition charges would be, which is probably why they didn't move forward, although certainly we've seen federal prosecutions of prosecutors, especially in recent days, in places like Aurora, Colorado, where they've been protesting a bad police killing from last year, a couple of other places as well, where organizers basically have been rounded up and facing federal charges. We'll see whether those charges stick, because if there is a change of regime in January, that would also mean a change of U.S. attorneys across the country. Those U.S. attorneys serve at the pleasure of the president, and they have largely been replaced with people in the mold of Donald Trump right now, which is why you're seeing these federal charges. So there's been that, but he also discussed charging Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkan with sedition, which is to say trying to undermine the country, the United States, because she quote unquote allowed CHOP. That is a direct result of how CHOP was portrayed in conservative media in places like Fox News, One America Network, etc., as sort of this lawless hellhole. When in fact it really wasn't, and certainly, you know, local right-wing media like Cairo Radio and Como TV did a lot to promote that narrative as well. And then it trickled up to national media. Yeah, so he wanted to charge Durkan with sedition for allowing that, six blocks of, you know, a country of millions of square miles, to exist, that six blocks was outside the reach of the United States, and therefore this was sedition. It's kind of tortured logic, legally speaking, and it certainly doesn't understand the nuances of the local politics of the situation. Number one, that Durkan is a close ally of the police, and she saw that withdrawal as the a way to de-escalate the situation, because the protests at the East Precinct were getting increasingly violent in early June, and the police responses were getting increasingly violent. So CHOP filled that vacuum once the police abandoned the precinct, and it was a way to de-escalate the police, honestly. So it really showed a complete lack of understanding and just going, you know, doing prosecutions on the basis of what you see on Fox News is generally not a good idea, put it that way. But, we found that out, today. And of course it burnishes Durkan's national credentials, as somebody who stood up to the Trump administration, which is, you know, not particularly accurate either, but, she'll take it. I'm sure she would, as with Governor Inslee, that they would be happy with positions in the Biden administration. But, that gives you an inkling of the police state kind of direction that we're headed in. And with that, let's transition to this week in awful national news.
Yeah, yesterday was quite a day in that Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed away, and social media pretty much just became overwhelmed with that. That was
Well, it's a major inflection point, I think. I think lost in the politics of all this was what a remarkable life Bader Ginsburg led. There were people last night spontaneously gathering to mourn her at the Supreme Court in Washington D.C. And I can think of maybe one other justice in my lifetime that has gotten that kind of response, which was Thurgood Marshall. And what they had in common was they were both civil rights pioneers, both in their private practice and then later when they joined the federal bench and then became members of the Supreme Court. Bader Ginsburg really was a pioneer in litigating for equal rights under the law between the sexes. She maintained that sensibility, not only around, gender equality, but also LGBTQ rights, where she was a strong force on the Supreme Court for, moving that forward. It's moved forward very quickly over the last couple decades, and she was a major reason why. She became really a cultural icon in the last, decade or so, as, you know, notorious RBG, and there was a movie made about her life. Or early on, before she became a Supreme Court member. And, all of that really burnished her reputation. That's why you had people spontaneously mourning her last night. Whereas, you know, in the maybe early 2000s, she was a relatively anonymous Supreme Court member. She was not that well known publicly, but, She became famous on the Supreme Court, particularly in the Bush and Trump administrations, for her dissents, which were often scathing. And, you know, really trying to stand up for individual rights and people's liberty and all the rest of that, and trying to bring the country closer to its professed ideals, which has been a fitful process for sure over the last couple decades. But she led a remarkable life, and she will be mourned. And she gave a third Supreme Court vacancy to Donald Trump to fill. He has 44 days, I think, before the election, which is a month and a half, basically. You know, both he and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, because Supreme Court nominations go through only the Senate, so they are entirely dependent on Republicans at this point for majority approval. Both he and McConnell have said last night and today that they intend to move post haste and get somebody installed before the election. Now, this is fraught for a few reasons. Number one, the fastest a Supreme Court nominee has ever been approved in the past is about 70 days, so about 2.5 months. But more importantly, only 4 years ago, Merrick Garland was nominated by Barack Obama, when Barack Obama was president, when Antonin Scalia abruptly died in February of 2016. That was 10 months before the election, and yet McConnell, as Senate Majority Leader at the time, and his fellow Republicans blocked Merrick Garland, who was a fairly centrist federal judge, who was Barack Obama's nomination to replace Scalia. You know, McConnell blocked that nomination from even having a hearing, let alone being voted on. And the excuse was, well, we can't do that during the election year. We should wait for the new president, whoever that might be, and it turned out to be between, you know, Clinton and Trump, to fill the seat I'll do that in January. And sure enough, Trump was elected, and so the Merrick Garland nomination was withdrawn as the new Senate was sworn in January. Trump nominated Neil Gorsuch, and Gorsuch is now on the Supreme Court. That was the first of his two nominations so far. The other one was Brett Kavanaugh, as we know. And so now he has a third, and he has I wouldn't be surprised if he has a nomination by Monday. I mean, you know, he's been going off of a Federalist Society list of really reactionary judges. That's how we found both Gorsuch and Kavanaugh. And so he's probably got somebody lined up that he wants to nominate. Probably the best known name that's been circulating is Senator Ted Cruz. And that probably would be as much to get him on the Supreme Court as to get him out of the Senate, where pretty much everybody despises him, but including his Republican colleagues. But I doubt it will be Cruz. It will probably be somebody who is on the bench. And of course, you know, Democrats are saying, well, you establish this standard of not processing any nominations during an election year, and we're a month out from an election. Mm-hmm. And the stakes here are extremely high. Another reactionary justice on the Supreme Court wouldn't just mean the end of abortion, which is what a lot of people are talking about today. It would also mean the end of environmental regulations, probably of all kinds. It would mean the end of voting rights protections. It would mean, possibly the end of Obamacare. That's a case that's sitting before the Supreme Court right now that the Trump administration has been trying to push the unconstitutionality of the entire Affordable Care Act, which they have no plan for replacing. So that would literally, just on the pre-existing conditions provision of that, that would throw 100 million Americans out of health insurance. So the kind of decisions that the Supreme Court could make in the very near future on really a wish list of reactionary activists you know, you would lose not just abortion rights, but probably privacy rights. So the right to contraception, especially for women, that might go away. You know, there's a whole laundry list of things that could be lost, when you have essentially a Trumpist Supreme Court with three of his nominees plus Clarence Thomas, plus the other reactionaries on the John Roberts court. It would be really have to be a slam dunk case for any of those conservative lawsuits to fail at the Supreme Court. And most immediately, it's part of the Trump reelection strategy. He was just handed a huge gift for the possibility of his remaining in office, even if he loses the election. And there are a number of legal paths by which that might work. What they all have in common is the assumption that despite all of his cheating, despite the stuff with the post office, despite the voter registration purges and the other voter suppression tactics, despite closing poll locations so that, for example, you have a handful of polling locations open in a large city because, you know, that city has a large minority population, and so you're trying to suppress the vote there. Despite the foreign assistance from Russia and potentially other countries that's been happening. And I suspect part of what's going on with Russia is, we're going to find this out later, surreptitious funneling of a ton of money from Russian oligarchs, from Russia with love. Some of that happened in 2016. We found out later with money being funneled through the NRA's PAC. They're a potential conduit again, but there's all sorts of ways that could happen right now. And again, it's not being enforced because none of the laws are being enforced because, Trump controls the Justice Department. And because the Federal Election Commission, which is supposed to monitor election spending, does not have a quorum right now because Trump has not filled vacancies on the commission for that agency. So, it's basically a lawless country in terms of what Trump can do right now. It really is a dictatorship already in that sense. But the election is a real potential inflection point, and people are really worried about that in terms of the Supreme Court, because if Biden somehow gets enough votes, despite all of the cheating, I think it's likely that he will, Trump will still say that the election was fraudulent. He's been making those noises for years, certainly, but definitely in the last weeks. And he has refused to say whether he would abide by the election results if they go against him. Sometimes he said he would, sometimes he said he wouldn't. So what if Biden actually gets enough votes? If you game this out, Trump refuses to say that he lost. He refuses to leave the White House. He appeals the results of the election on whatever grounds. I mean, he could mess with the Electoral College, with the Republican state certification of electors. There's a number of ways he could do it. And it goes to the Supreme Court, and his hand-picked Supreme Court sides with him, and he stays in office. That's a dictatorship right there. That's how it works. And my fear is that if the Republicans can successfully get somebody placed on the Supreme Court to replace Ginsburg's liberal vote with a reactionary vote, in the next 6 weeks, that is the firewall that Trump needs to guarantee his re-election, no matter what the voters of the United States have to say. And at that point, I think all hell breaks loose. The only thing that can hold him accountable at this point is, and we've said this even before Ginsburg's death, is people in the streets. We've heard over and over again from people who study how countries that were democracies, moved to dictatorships, where those strong persons and autocrats have been successful, your institutions will not save you. the one thing that will stop them is a crisis of legitimacy, of people in the streets saying this is not a legitimate government. And if that's how the election goes, and the Ginsburg's vacancy makes that more likely, it may come to that. It's going to be, people have been saying it's going to be a wild, 6 weeks until the election. No, it's going to be a wild 3.5 months. The only thing that's written in stone at this point with our Constitution is the inauguration day has to be January 20th. So between now and then, I don't know what's going to happen, but at the national level, it's going to be a wild ride. And at the global level, a lot of countries are fearful of what the United States is about to go through.
Republican senators Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski have already come out and said that they do not support having a vote, a replacement put forward until after the election. Do you anticipate any others any other Republicans coming forward to support that?
Well, the only other obvious name that people are talking about is Mitt Romney, and that would make three, and you would need four. Three leaves a tie in the Senate, which would be broken by Mike Pence. But the thing is, I don't think Murkowski is genuinely independent, and the politics of Alaska are that she can get away with it. Collins is in a really tough reelection fight that she is likely going to lose. She has a well-earned reputation about expressing skepticism for something that her party or Donald Trump or somebody on her side is doing, only to back down at the last moment and vote that way anyway. Brett Kavanaugh is the most famous example, but people in Maine remember a number of them, which is why, number one, she's losing her reelection bid in the polls right now. That seat is likely to flip to Democrats. But secondly, nobody trusts her. So, I don't think that's a solid commitment at all, because with Susan Collins, it's never a solid commitment. Murkowski is also not predictable, and you can be sure there will be a ton of pressure on her to toe the party line. And I honestly don't know who, even if they stay firm on this, and there's a fourth that does. Now, there are, social media today has a bunch of clips of Republican senators, stating on principle that we can't possibly consider Obama's judicial nominee from 2016, juxtaposed with their video from the last 24 hours saying, well, of course we have to consider President Trump's nominee. This is a totally different situation. hypocrisy in the Republican Party is not a disqualifying candidate. It's a job requirement. People like McConnell and Lindsey Graham, who's the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, who would be hearing any nominee and, expediting those hearings, I'm sure. They're quite comfortable saying the exact opposite of what they were saying 4 years ago, because there is an organizing principle. But it's not that we need to leave that for a new presidential term. It's that we need to stay in power. That is the only organizing principle. And you can deny that you said something that was on tape yesterday, and that's fine if it serves the purpose of staying in power. It's a remarkably cynical approach to governing. And, with a widely viewed state propaganda arm like Fox News, and then others that have come up online and One America Network and things like that, you've got a solid third of the American population that gets its memory wiped every 24 hours. It really is incredibly cynical as a governing strategy. Because they're not actually governing either, as we've seen with the coronavirus pandemic. What they are doing is trying to extract as much wealth as possible for themselves and their friends and use the power that they have accrued to do it. And at the same time, there's some ideological components. A lot of the cultural war stuff, like, you know, abortion is the obvious example. The whole purpose of that is to, keep the base riled up. And that's what a lot of the propaganda efforts in things like Fox News are about too. You know, stoke the hatred, stoke the fear. The real fear with the election is not just that Bush will contest it, it's that he has a, in some cases, heavily armed base of supporters that are fanatical enough to try and form, essentially the equivalent of a dictatorship's paramilitary, you know, the Red Guards or, Hitler Youth, whatever it might be. They're out there and willing, and we've seen that with things like the Patriot Prayer and Proud Boys, and there's a Proud Boy rally coming up next weekend in Portland that's going to be very contentious. That's being held in Vanport, which is an area of the city that was once a redlined enclave for African Americans. So the symbolism of their holding it there is pretty offensive. It's going to get a response, I'm sure. Anyway, I'm rambling, but
okay.
The whole fear around the election is not just that Bush will contest it. It's that he will encourage Trump. I'm sorry. It's not just that Trump will contest it. It's that he will encourage violence on his behalf. And so at the same time, number one, the only way that, I think a dictatorship can be prevented at this point is a mass outpouring of, criticism of his legitimacy. And that includes public protest. Like, I'm talking at a scale of millions of people. It has been done in other countries. We've never seen anything like that in this country. But, at the same time, Bush is going to encourage violence against protesters.
Trump.
I don't know why I'm saying Bush. I know why I'm on.
I know why you're saying Bush.
Yeah. It's one of the first signs of dementia. Oh dear. Where am I? Oh, I'm on the radio. dear Lord. The concern is not only that it will take millions of people in a crisis of legitimacy to displace Bush, particularly Trump. oh dear, I'm going to start giggling. It's not only that there will be a crisis of legitimacy, it will take millions of people on the streets, but also that Trump is going to encourage both police violence against protesters, is going to encourage Department of Justice prosecutions. We've seen, people being picked up in unmarked vans and whisked off, to be questioned without charges in Portland and in Kenosha and, I believe in Chicago as well. And that's being seen as a potential dry run for post-election, protests. And then, the prosecution that we learned about Bill Barr's desire to prosecute people for protesting and prosecute elected officials for, in the case of Manny Durkin, for allowing the protests. And he has, right-wing vigilantes that he can call on to encourage violence against protesters, above and beyond the police violence. And, these are all very scary scenarios, but they're very realistic scenarios at this point. And they're realistic scenarios that I think people on the left, and not just people on the left, but anybody in this country who is actually concerned about American democracy, which is probably at least two-thirds of the country at this point, more in places like Seattle and with people within the sound of my voice, that at this point is a super majority of people that I think would be outraged by these kind of developments. We need to start thinking about how to strategically respond to that kind of scenario. And hopefully it doesn't come to pass, but it looks more likely with every week, honestly. And every week we do this show and we go over the news of the week and we analyze what it means. And what it means is that kind of a dystopian scenario is becoming more and more and more plausible. We need to be prepared and we need to be smart about it. I think protests, for example, have to be nonviolent because we have to have the moral high ground. in that kind of chaotic situation where the right wing is promoting violence. We have to promote nonviolence. You know, there needs to be a crisis of legitimacy around the Trump presidency. That probably should have happened in 2016, where he probably should not have been elected president for not for all the ways that he cheated with Russian help and all the rest of it. But it's definitely going to be the case if he winds up not cooperating with a peaceful transition of power in 2020. This has been a nightmare year, so why not make it worse? And we're also likely to see a much worse situation with COVID in the coming weeks as well. So 2020 is not over yet.
All right. Let's move on. We've got a few more items here on national. Pennsylvania Supreme Court weighing in.
Yeah. We have seen Trump's voter suppression tactics. We talked at the beginning of the show about the federal judge in Yakima trying to restore the changes to the Postal Service. We also had a significant court decision yesterday in Pennsylvania, Thursday in Pennsylvania, where the Supreme Court there ruled in favor of a lawsuit that was trying to extend the deadline for mail-in balloting. Pennsylvania, of course, was a key swing state in 2016, and they are one of the states where a lot of people have applied for absentee ballots, and so it was being potentially affected by the slowdowns in the Postal Service. And one of the ways that works is that for absentee ballots to be counted in Pennsylvania, they have to arrive by Election Day, not be mailed by Election Day, as in Washington State, but they actually had to arrive by Election Day. So if the mail is being slowed, it makes sense that a lot of people would either have to vote earlier, or if they're not aware that you know, you don't vote by Election Day, you vote by a week before Election Day if you want your vote to be counted potentially. And even then, maybe it's going to sit in a sack of mail and not arrive for another couple weeks, and then your vote won't count. So the Pennsylvania Supreme Court agreed to extend the mailing, the deadline for mail to be ballots to be counted, so that as long as they were mailed by Election Day, if they arrive by 3 days after Election Day, which would be that Friday, then they can be counted. That will help. That will help people's vote be counted. It isn't necessarily in favor of Republicans or Democrats, other than Democrats are more likely to vote by mail, people think, this year. That's not necessarily true. For instance, people afraid of COVID tend to be elderly, tend to skew Republican, and they're going to want to vote by mail. They're not necessarily going to want to go vote in person. It's just the Trump supporters who don't believe that COVID's a thing, QAnon supporters, people who think hoaxes are an masks are an impingement on their freedom, et cetera, et cetera. You know, so it's not entirely clear whether voting by mail this year will favor Republicans or Democrats. Republicans are certainly operating as though it will favor Democrats. Maybe they think that their voters are all too stupid to think that pandemic is real, because Trump has been saying that it's over, so it must be over. It's not over, and I'll get to that in a minute. But yeah, so voters in Pennsylvania got a big win yesterday, and Thursday, and that has been a trend in court decisions lately that have been going against Trump administration voter suppression efforts. Let's hope that trend continues, because almost all of the things that I mentioned earlier that they're trying to do are the subject of lawsuits that are being heard in a bunch of different states right now. So I'm trying to track that as best we can, and we'll follow that going forward.
Also this week, the announcement of a Patriotic Education Commission.
Oh, God, yes. This was something that Trump announced to great fanfare this week, and it's another culture war thing to appeal to his base. the claim that, you know, cultural studies and all that kind of stuff is profoundly un-American, and not only that, false, that the United States is the greatest country ever, and it's basically a white supremacist curriculum for schools that has been developed in the right-wing fever swamp. That, you know, downplays slavery, downplays, you know, Native American genocide, downplays, some of the uglier aspects of what genuinely does, have a, you know, a history that, does stand for freedom and really did have a place in world history as the birthplace of democracy. But at the same time, it also has a lot of flaws, and there's been a movement in recent years to look at that with clearer eyes, look at that not through solely through the eyes of the founding invading Europeans that overtook the North America and then brought people from Africa to work the land for them. So Trump wants to replace all this. He doesn't actually have the authority to do that because, school curricula is determined by individual universities, number one, and number two, by individual school districts and states. There's certainly been a concerted right-wing effort in recent years to try and influence school curricula. We see this most notably in Texas, where there's a state commission that controls school book purchases. And because Texas is so large and has so many students, what Texas decides for school books often determines what publishing companies publish. So, because it's that kind of an order is, makes it financially viable for the companies. So, the Texas Commission rules that they don't want the Vietnam War portrayed a certain way, publishing companies will pressure the individual book authors to not portray Vietnam that way so they can get the Texas order. So things like that have been going on for decades. We've seen that with Betsy DeVos's tenure in the Secretary of Education, where it hasn't just been about charter schools and funneling money to private schools, funding taxpayer money to private schools. It's also been about trying to influence school curricula. And this is the latest salvo in that. It's essentially a cultural war thing. It's not entirely clear whether that will ever happen. There's not much time before the election. And, Trump, of course, knows this. And if he is not in office after this, then it's not ever going to become a thing. It may be one of those promises that once he doesn't have to worry about another election, he'll just forget about it. He has other things to worry about, like establishing a dictatorship. But it is a signal for what he thinks appeals to his base and what the right wing wants to hear. And what they want to hear at this point is slavery was good. You know, we need to save all the monuments for our Confederate heroes. It's an openly white supremacist appeal. And, you know, the real danger with the passing of Ruth Bader Ginsburg is that we're one step closer to a white supremacist dictatorship. And those are three words that I think people need to start repeating over and over and over. White supremacist dictatorship. Because that's the direction we're headed. I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but that's where we are.
Yeah, well, luckily I'm sitting down, so. give us an update on COVID.
Yeah, we are at, 200,000 deaths right now. We are approaching past 8 million infections. It's not looking good. And what we're hearing from experts like Anthony Fauci and public health officials in all over the country is, you know, there are some parts of the country that are starting to do better now, and Washington is starting to do better now. Both Western Washington and Eastern Washington, new cases have been declining for several weeks. That's the good news. Their bad news is that we're heading into fall and winter, when more people are indoors, when it gets colder, when we have flu season start, And the concern at that point is, number one, COVID can spread much more easily once people are indoors, especially in areas where mass compliance is not high. And secondly, that medical facilities, which still 8 months in, do not have enough personal protective equipment for medical providers. We've had over 1,000 healthcare workers in this country die in the course of the pandemic. That is a staggering number, because those are generally healthy people too. With fall and winter coming on, there's likely to be a strong resurgence of the pandemic, which is already one of the most extensive in the world in terms of per capita new cases each day. We're seeing cases rise again in parts of Europe, especially France and Spain, and also the UK. We are seeing a completely out of control pandemic in India. And there's other parts of the world. Latin America is still struggling badly with COVID-19. And the risk is, in this country, which is also one of the worst in the world at this point already, we not only have a federal government that is actively trying to undermine the response to the pandemic. They're not just trying to solve it. They're trying to stymie people who are trying to solve it. And we saw a number of developments on that front in the past week that I don't have time to get into right now. But the fear is that it's going to get worse during winter, and that it may be next spring or summer, at least, before we have any kind of distribution of vaccine. It ain't going to be by election day, I can promise you that. It's not going to be by the end of the year. And with all of those factors, number one, it's probably going to be several more months at least, and they're going to be politically very chaotic months, before we can get the pandemic under control. And a Biden administration would help a lot, I'm sure. That's just one more thing where, voting for Trump means voting for chaos and death, basically. It's a scary time in the course of the pandemic, because it's something that people's attention is not going to be on as much in terms of the news and media coverage over the next few months. But the virus does not care what we're going through, except it loves crowds, especially indoor crowds. And it's something we still have to be vigilant for, even as we protest, even as we gather in groups to try and, save our country.
All right.
It's been a cheerful show.
It's been very uplifting, as it usually is.
Yes. We can laugh. At least there's that. It keeps us sane. The morning and evening marches continue despite it all in Seattle, marching for racial justice. I think that's going to be morphing into a march to save all our collective asses soon enough. So the Morning March Seattle that's the name of the Facebook page where you can find out where people are gathering each morning. And then there's an Instagram page, Seattle Evening March, for the evening marches. They both convene in different places around the metro area each day. And, they're a lot of fun. And they, as we've been covering in the last few weeks, have been going to different decision makers' homes. They go to different places that are symbolically or practically important to racial justice and moving that struggle forward. So go join them. And there's also usually streams online that you can find, both for Seattle and other cities like, we don't have time to talk about, but Portland and Rochester and Louisville that are doing daily protests. So check that out. And I believe starting this week, there will be daily stuff going on across from the White House too.
All right. Well, we will hopefully talk to you this same time next week.
And hopefully we'll have Maria back too.
Fingers crossed.